Hello, I'm Nick Watt and welcome to Politics Weekly.
Dennis Skinner. Yeah, there.
Will the Prime Minister give us a rock-solid assurance whatever he does in order to clear the debts of the nation's finances, he will never, ever meet a Russian billionaire to try and catch the money. We'll leave that to the
Yes, that was the old bruiser, the beast of Bolsover, Dennis Skinner, attempting to pile the pressure on the Tories over the story that has dominated the week. That is the disclosure that the Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, discussed whether to take a £50,000 donation from a Russian billionaire. We'll be asking where Donorgate leaves George Osborne and another famous politician who also enjoyed hospitality this summer on the yacht owned by Oleg Deripaska. That is the noble Lord Mandelson of Foy and Hartlepool. We will also discuss just how bad the downturn is going to be after Gordon Brown finally uttered the R word. Yes, the Prime Minister said this week we were entering a recession. Finally, we will turn our attention across the Atlantic to the US election and ask what will happen over there will mean for us over here. Joining me to discuss these matters is Tim Montgomery, the editor of the Conservative Home website. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Nick.
We have Martin Kettle, the Guardian columnist. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Nick.
And finally, we have Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer. Hello, Julian.
Hello, Nick.
Well, the week has been dominated by the incendiary disclosure that George Osborne discussed a £50,000 donation from a Russian billionaire, Oleg Deripaska. This tasty nugget entered the public domain after the Shadow Chancellor's old Oxford friend, Nat Rothschild, accused Osborne of soliciting the donation during a visit to Deripaska's yacht whilst it was moored outside his Corfu villa this summer. Rothschild is on the warpath because he's furious with Osborne for leaking details about discussions with another guest at his villa, Peter Mandelson. Osborne denies soliciting a donation, though he has not denied discussing it.
This is a very serious matter indeed, and I hope it's investigated by the authorities.
That was Gordon Brown. Martin Kettle, you are a man of taste. Can I ask you what I think is the key question? What has happened to our political elite when they queue up to jump on board a gin palace? Aren't such vessels the height of vulgarity?
Well, I don't know, Nick. I don't know if you spent any time on any yachts in the Mediterranean recently. I certainly haven't. It's about two things. It's about the aphrodisiac of power and money and the convergence between the two, which is as old as politics and as old as money. And it's secondly about the way we fund our political parties, that you have to get money in order to get elected.
So, Julian, it's about the aphrodisiac of power and money, and that politicians obviously have to raise money to fight elections, as Martin is saying. But you wrote a column in The Guardian this week. Very simple. Those two, Osborne and Mandelson, should not have been on that yacht.
Yes, because it's about a third thing as well, which is new Russian money. It's not just old wealth. Winston Churchill, in his declining days, used to swan around the Mediterranean all sorts of yachts, and people didn't mind that too much. But there's a question about the man who owned this boat, and it's probably better that people weren't close to him.
Now, Tim Montgomery, you're the editor of the Conservative Home website, so you have an insight into that party. Do you think George Osborne showed poor judgment in over the summer?
Well, I prefer that he hadn't been on that yacht. I prefer that he hadn't have breached the confidentiality of his conversation with Peter Mandelson. I think those were both mistakes. But I think there's been a sort of feverish mindset in Westminster over the last 48 hours when George Osborne has been pursued relentlessly in a way that Peter Mandelson hasn't been, frankly. And I've put my cantankerous right-wing head on just for a moment for you. But there you have Peter Mandelson when he was EU Trade Commissioner, potentially having had this relationship with this Russian oligarch and actually relaxing trade relations with Russia in such a way that this guy benefits to the tune of perhaps £50 million. A much, much bigger story. And we haven't seen the focus on Peter Mandelson that I think that is justified by that. What we've had is a focus on George Osborne when the Conservative Party did not receive one penny, not one ruble from this guy.
So, Julian, yet ruble for the Conservatives. Do you think George Osborne's been treated unfairly this week?
No, I don't think he has been. It's true that there wasn't any money taken. There clearly was money discussed, and there was a visit by the Conservative Party chief executive to this infamous yacht as well. So it isn't a case of a complete accident where there was no potential donation. There was a talk of a donation. And Peter Mandelson's been all over the press too, and the Guardian certainly covered
that. Nothing on this scale, though, Julian. We've had 48 hours where the machine, particularly I think of the BBC, the Sun has gone in full attack mode on the BBC over this. But George Osborne is an incredibly important figure to the Conservative Party. One of my commentators on the blog really describes him as second among equals. He's the guy that makes most of the big strategic calls for the Conservative Party. The Labour Party are desperate to bring him down. And I think there's been a sense in which the media have all played to Peter Mandelson's tune again. He's orchestrated this attack.
Well, they started playing to George Osborne's tune, of course, because the story began, I think, in the Sunday Times from a conversation with Peter Mandelson that George Osborne, we believe, encouraged to appear in the press. So he's played the game too, and he's now been bitten by it, and that's a bit unfortunate. I think there is an element of hysteria in the way we've behaved. It's one of those political scandals which everybody gets very excited about. You get graphics in the papers, there's one in The Guardian this week, which made my head hurt when I tried to follow it, of who's friends with who and whose boat and whose taverna and which terrace. It begins to make no sense. For a minute, we remember it all. And then a month later, if you said to people, explain that crisis, what was the thing that really was wrong? Nobody can remember. That's true of some where people resign too. The Charles Clarke affair was a bit like that at times. But I think also what's happened is we've had a financial crisis for a month. The political class, the political media have been kept off the front pages. I mean, we've all felt a bit lost and lonely while all these city types have had all the coverage. Suddenly, here's a story where the lobby can pile in, political journalists can pile in, recapture the news agenda. And maybe George Osborne's been a bit of a victim of that.
Julian Glover, are you suggesting that lobby journalists are only capable of doing lifestyle stories and not heavyweight political and economic analysis?
Martin, I put the blame solely with the news desks, who asks these lobby journalists who always want to do heavy policy stories.
It's very tough on us.
And make you write about Corfu instead.
That's right. But not sadly go there. Sorry, Martin, were you want to come in?
Well, I think George Osborne's actually had a tough couple of days. But actually, by the time you get to Thursday's papers, I think it's pretty clear that there is a truce more or less been called, and that the Murdoch press is in the course of trying to hose things down. And so, you know, I think in some respects the press is more biddable in the case of a Conservative politician than it would be if it was a Labour politician. I mean, Peter Mandelson, for all his colourful career, can hardly be accused of not having been looked at in extensive detail in the media over at least 15 years. The thing is, it's new for George Osborne. He hasn't been held up to the light, hasn't been really made to sweat under the lights. This week he has.
And can I just ask you, Martin, do you think that this shows a problem with George Osborne? Because some people say that his great strength, which is a fantastic political brain, which is a calculating political brain, can also be his weakness, which is he looks for tactical advantages and doesn't think of the strategic implications. And obviously the example was, came back from his holiday, blabbered to the Sunday Times about his conversations with Peter Mandelson, bit Students' Union.
Well, I know people say that. I mean, the truth is that an awful lot of politicians do that. An awful lot of politicians go on holiday with journalists as well as with Russian financiers, probably rather more, I suspect. So, you know, that social intercourse is, you know, that's what happens. I think Osborne has... I think he was at the heart of this discussion. I mean, you know, I think he was probably keen to get some money from the Russians and was keen to find ways in which it could happen. That's the real story that hasn't quite been nailed, and I suspect now it's not going to be nailed.
Yeah. And sorry, Julian.
One thing that comes out of this, I think, is that the Shadow Chancellor shouldn't be involved in party fundraising, and that must be made clear now. There's no reason why he should be. Gordon Brown, perhaps to Tony Blair's frustration, sometimes did stay away from Labour fundraising and tried to claim he was clean hands in the peerage saga. Osborne ought to be the same.
Isn't that a really important point, Tim, that Gordon Brown, I know you're obviously not one of his greatest fans, but he did, as Shadow Chancellor and then Chancellor, just not go anywhere near party funding?
I think that was wise, and I think probably there will be some thinking at central office to keep George Osborne well away from this. It's hard though, because it's also true that, you know, George Osborne will be meeting leading people of the city, leading business people, to help understand what's going on in the real economy at the moment. Sometimes those will be donors, and it's a hard thing to play and be completely clean when this is an issue that the media are so interested in finding fault with, when actually it's just is legitimate meetings with people who've got economic advice to give to the Conservative Treasury team.
Yeah. Osborne's role also plays to something else, and another flaw I think the Conservatives have, which they need to address, which is that he's been building up a central office campaign structure. He's not only been Shadow Chancellor and he's been raising money. Partly, I wonder, perhaps to strengthen the party against Lord Ashcroft, and the danger if Osborne backs away is that Ashcroft mustn't then return to be the dominant figure he has been in the past.
Yeah, well, one of the successes that has happened under David Cameron is that we are no longer so dependent on Ashcroft. You know, there are many, many more people giving £50,000 to the Conservative Party.
But Osborne's had the strength to take on Ashcroft in a way that, you know, Caroline Spelman doesn't.
But I think you know, listeners shouldn't get the impression that Gordon Brown doesn't think about how to pay for Labour political campaigns, or indeed his own political campaigns. I mean, he is a quiet fundraiser. The thing is, he tends to raise money for his own support institutions. There is the whole controversy about the Smith Institute, which has dogged him in recent years. And I mean, if you actually look at the list of people who gave money to his leadership campaign, albeit that his leadership campaign was unopposed, it's an interesting list of influential people, some of whom have now become ministers in his government. They all play the game to some extent. That doesn't mean they're all corrupt at all. It means that's the game they're compelled to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, thank you for that. We are now going to leave lifestyle journalism behind and face up to the heavy issue of Britain's economy. We asked Simon Hoggett, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, to describe the scenes in the Commons this week when the Osborne affair and the economy were raised.
Questions to the Prime Minister.
We've just come out of a very, very ill-tempered Prime Minister's question time. Of course, all that MPs are talking about behind the scenes is the business of George Osborne and the Russian billionaire's yacht, and did he or didn't he try to get some money for the Tory party, and the course of his 5 meetings with this very well-heeled fellow. And the other thing is, what has Peter Mandelson got to do with it? Anyway, then Gordon Brown arrived. And of course, the only topic of the day was the recession and what the Governor of the Bank of England had to say.
Mr. Speaker, the Governor of the Bank of England said last night that not since the First World War has the international banking system been so close to collapse. And I agree with him. Having taken action on the banking system, we must now take action on the global financial recession, which is likely to cause recession in America, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, and, because no country can insulate itself from it, Britain too. And that is why
Gordon Brown doesn't really always does, which is to imply that somehow it's got nothing to do with him or indeed Britain as a whole. We're just sort of swept up, you know. Even the chap with the umbrella is going to get a little bit wet when the typhoon strikes, is his general implication. Of course, the Tories thought that was absolutely hilarious, because their view is, and they may well be right, that we are in a much worse position than anyone else.
Of course borrowing goes up in a downturn. His problem is he racked it up to record levels before the downturn began. How can he possibly think it's right to go into recession with such a high level of debt? Why can't he just admit for once he got it wrong? And he keeps quoting the national debt figures. Let's look at what that doesn't include. Billions of pounds on PFI, Network Rail, pension liabilities. That's even before
David Cameron
leapt
up and talked about the biggest deficit in the developed world. He's borrowing so much, he said, he cannot lecture us about transparency. Gordon Brown hit back and quoted Cameron as saying that we should always... that leaders of the opposition should always be very careful, they shouldn't talk down the economy, there are strong fundamentals in the British economy, we should celebrate those.
For the government to increase economic activity in the economy by borrowing to do so. Now, which side is he on? Is he on the side of what he said 2 weeks ago or the side of what he said a week ago?
Of course.
It was all Punch and Judy stuff, but of course there is a fundamental point here. What Cameron is saying is, we will support you in digging ourselves out of this hole, but never let it be forgotten that it was you who created the hole in the first place. And that's the fault line, if you like, between the two. Meanwhile, Gordon Brown is saying that it's the right thing to do to borrow our way out of deficit. The Tories are saying that we're the only major developed country which had so little in the cupboard that we actually do have to borrow such phenomenal quantities of money just in order to keep the economy on an even keel.
The answer shows, Mr. Speaker, this Prime Minister
is more often.
He's all at sea. He's all at sea. Well, if not in a luxury yacht like some prominent members of the opposition. But, Mr. Speaker,
I'm there. Please allow the Right Honourable Gentleman to be heard. The Right Honourable Gentleman.
And by the end, the whole question of George Osborne came up far more blatantly. Osborne himself, David Cameron, all the others on the front bench, collapsed in mock laughter to show how little they cared about this attack. And on that note, Prime Minister's question time ended.
That was Simon Hoggart. So, Julian Glover, we are in a recession, but if Gordon Brown is to believe, this is a global problem and nothing to do with him.
Yes, it's a bit like we've caught flu from somebody we bumped into on the train, and it's not our fault. That isn't really what the public think. I think the public do see him as quite integral to what we're facing. We did some polling at the start of the week before the Osborne thing blew up, in which the Tory party had a very narrow lead as the best party in the economy, and they had a 12-point lead in terms of a general election vote. So Labour's taking a hit from this. It's possibly recovering a little bit over the last few months. The poll gap has narrowed slightly. But Gordon Brown's claim that he's innocent isn't going to work with the public. They remember him saying they returned to boom and bust. He tries to deny he ever said it, but he said it a lot. And Cameron hit him with that in the Commons this week.
Martin, you were writing about that Guardian ICM poll this week. Do you think we're in the territory where Gordon Brown was able to get the line up there that there's a financial crisis that is global, but when it comes to the recession, you can't blame anyone else for that?
I think Gordon Brown, whether he likes it or not, owns the recession politically in this country. And in that ICM poll this week, the respondents were asked whether they thought that various causes were related to were responsible for this. And, you know, roughly 80 to 90% said, yes, it was international turbulence. Yes, it was the American housing market. Yes, it was the bankers. Yes, it was too much borrowing. But yes, it was also the government. And that's the reality, that the government is one of the causes of this in the public's eyes. And Gordon Brown will try to deny that because he is somebody who does try to deny things and won't say things in public. I thought it was really surprising. He actually was prepared to mention the word recession yesterday. It was quite striking.
It was like when Margaret Thatcher first said poll tax. It was a slip.
Although
out.
He mentioned it with great care, didn't he? And it was within the context of it.
And in a very characteristic and convoluted way, where it just sort of slipped out at the end.
Yeah.
This is somebody who has not, in my experience, ever said that unemployment has risen in this country. You know, he's very careful not to say things like that. So it was, if you take the view that he's a disciplined person, then I think, you know, he did mean to say this. And that it's all the more striking for that, you know, the recession is out there. It's political reality. And, you know, Brown's task in the next 18 months to the general election, or whenever the election actually is to acknowledge that things are bad, but to claim that Labour is best equipped to deal with that.
Tim, where do you think this leaves us? It's interesting, the Guardian poll there saying Gordon Brown getting praise for his handling of the financial crisis, but absolutely no change in the headline figures for the parties.
Well, I think there's a lot of relief, actually, in Conservative circles. I think we've been off the stage, apart from the George Osborne issue, for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. It's been Brown, been painted in newspapers as the Superman saving the financial system. And I think the Conservatives were braced for a big reduction in our opinion poll lead. And actually, when the Guardian poll, 12 points, and one in the Mirror from YouGov, 8 points, Maury actually showing the Conservatives up 15 points. So actually, to still be well on course for a comfortable majority, when Gordon Brown has had his best publicity since calling off the election last year, I think there's a lot of relief in Conservative Central Office, and I think perhaps a belief that actually the public really has decided against Brown. And whether he starts every sentence on the economy blaming America for the importing of these problems, I think the politics of this look reasonably good for the Conservatives.
But do you think it's quite difficult? The line that David Cameron is trying to get up there is that you've borrowed too much, to which Gordon Brown says, but you accept that borrowing has to rise when you're in a recession, to which David Cameron says, yes, but you, Gordon Brown, borrowed too much when the sun was shining. That's quite a difficult distinction to get up, isn't it? Do you think?
It is. I actually think the most important political event of this week was an interview that David Cameron gave on the Today programme. And there was an opportunity, I think, for the Conservatives in the middle of this crisis to almost say, the economic situation has changed so fundamentally, we're going to revisit some of our economic positions. David Cameron didn't do that. He actually defended exactly where he was, which was that they weren't going to take risks with the public finances. There would still be no tax cuts. There would be no stimulus. The most important person, really, in the British economy at the moment is Mervyn King, because what David Cameron's economic position effectively is that as long as we keep the public finances under reasonably tight rein, the Bank of England will be able to cut interest rates. If we take risks with the public finances, there will be no room for the Bank of England to cut interest rates. So what the Conservative Party is essentially saying, I don't think in essence really the Labour position is that different, is everything now depends on a monetary relaxation to mitigate the costs of recession. So it's now Mervyn King and the Monetary Policy Council that really will decide how serious this recession is going to be for the UK.
It's Mervyn King and monetary policy, but if you were Chancellor, you'd be cutting taxes, wouldn't you?
Well, I think the state has grown far too big, far too fat in the UK, and I would like to see a lot of reallocation of money that's currently going on state spending into reductions of taxation. I'd have emergency economy boosting tax relief. But that's my position. It's not the position of the Conservative front bench. The Conservative front bench have effectively ruled that out.
So Julian, if Chancellor Tim Montgomery is saying that the political environment in this recession is quite good for the Conservatives, and obviously you would say that the Guardian ICM poll is bearing that out, presumably it's not all that bad for Gordon Brown. He set up this new National Economic Council, a war cabinet to meet on the economy. Peter Mandelson's been brought back. Is it all over for Labour or not?
No, it's not all over. The momentum is going Labour's way, although the poll leads are big. Still, for the Tories, they're less big than they were. And Gordon Brown has responded with a vigour that few people thought he had in him in the summer. His personal sort of demeanour has changed. His energy at PMQs, he's hitting Cameron in a way he never did before. He was using quotes and back and forth and things he didn't manage. So there's a sense of energy and vigour. What he can't do is stop a recession. And so the public may see a man who looks energetic and is trying to lead and trying to promise to protect people. But if they still get repossessed, and particularly if it's a recession that hits the south of England very heavily, hits the kind of middle classes who put money into property, they may not see Brown as the solution to that.
Well, we're now going to peer across the Atlantic to the US presidential election, which takes place on the 4th of November. Barack Obama appears to be ahead of John McCain in the polls, but the Democrat is warning his supporters to take nothing for granted. Martin Kettle, you are a former Washington bureau chief for The Guardian. Can you tell me how you think it's going? You recently quoted Garrison Keillor's remark about John F. Kennedy and said that Obama has more keys on his piano.
I think Americans have looked at these two candidates in the three debates and in the intensive period of the campaign, which started at the beginning of September, and more or less decided that Barack Obama is the man for these times. I think it's possible that there'll be something dramatic will happen, but basically I think you've got to assume that these polls are telling the truth. They're very consistent. The lead is substantial. The leads in the polls in the battleground states, so-called, under the Electoral College system, are also substantial. McCain is having to defend in states that he should be counting on rather than attack in states that he should be winning. So I think both sides agree that Obama has the advantage. And it's really beginning, I think, to be a question of how big the majority is going to be, not whether he has one.
What about the Bradley effect? That, I think, is named after the 1982 contest for the governorship of California, where a popular African-American mayor of Los Angeles stood for the governorship, was ahead in the polls. When it came to election day, he lost. And it was because people, when they told pollsters, said, yes, of course, I'll vote for him. But in the privacy of the booth, they didn't.
Well, I think that is a possibility. On the other hand, Tom Bradley is not the only African-American ever to have stood for public office in the United States in the last 20 years. There have been lots and lots and lots of others. And that so-called Bradley effect has not always been replicated in other places. It's obviously one of those possible issues. But really, looking at the campaign, I mean, what's really striking is how little race has been an issue in this campaign, not how much. The issue, as far as one can sense from this side of the Atlantic, is America ready for an African-American president? It's who's best able to deal with the economy. And that's, I think, why Obama's leading and why I think he's probably going to win.
Tim Montgomery, I'm going to turn to you and ask you in a very sensitive manner, because, of course, you are a supporter for Senator John McCain. How's it looking? Are you nervous? Are you worried?
I think it's very bleak for John McCain. I wrote an article for the Daily Telegraph in the last week and made the case for John McCain, really after a large number of Conservatives had abandoned the sort of Republican ship. We've seen in recent times Ian Dale, Dan Hannan, and most prominently of all, Boris Johnson, all endorse Barack Obama. And I think there's a nervousness, you know, it's part of, you know, within the special relationship between Britain and America. There was once a special relationship between the Conservative Party and the Republican Party. And that's under strain, partly for the war on terror, partly for the difference now between social values of the Republicans and the Conservatives. But I'm still hoping for a McCain victory, largely because I think the most important issue of our time still is the war on terror. Despite the present focus on the economy. Actually, I think it's hugely underreported, the success that the Bush White House has begun to make on the war on terror. And I think McCain would be most likely to continue that. Who amongst us here thought on the day after September the 11th that there would not be a huge series of major terrorist attacks on major world cities? The fact is that hasn't happened. There have been exceptions, of course, 7/7 and one or two others. But Bush's approach has largely succeeded at considerable cost. And I am not sure that Barack Obama will continue to keep America on the front foot in this war.
So, Julian, there's Tim concerned that Barack Obama won't be hardline enough. I mean, if Barack Obama is elected, do you think there will be a love-in between Britain and the US, between Europe and the US, or will certain realities always be there?
I think Obama might have to try quite hard not to have a love-in. There'll be an attempted love-in by British politicians, all of whom will suddenly announce that they've been his friend since birth and they've learned everything he's got to say and they are the change and every single thing will be copied. The Tories certainly in a position to try and do that, but Labour has good claim to it as well. There'll be a need for Obama to stand up for America, to be a bit protectionist. He'll do things we won't like. The dream won't be prolonged that long, but it does look like he's winning. And just watching it from outside, it's quite impressive, this election. You see these wonderful photos of crowds of people gathering in the street to him, speak at rallies. You see a contest which has debated issues, as well as the cost of the shadow vice president's clothes. And it's something we might learn from in terms of how we do politics here as well. I think the debates weren't stunning, but they were interesting. It's kind of things we don't get. And while we're busy worrying about people going onto yachts, they are trying to talk about the economy and who's got the best plan.
And it's interesting, Martin, Julian, there, talking about how important the presidential debates were. You wrote a column this week saying they are important, but the media got them completely wrong.
Well, I mean, it's a matter of fact that the media got them completely wrong. I mean, there were three debates between McCain and Obama. And the first one, the media came out and said McCain's won it. The second one, they came out and said it was a draw. And the third one, they said McCain's won this one as well. So definitely McCain's supposed to have been McCain's victory in the debates. Actually, after each debate, Obama's poll ratings have strengthened and McCain's have weakened. And I think, you know, the debates are actually not about who's going to land the so-called knockout blow. The debates are actually about people engaging with the process in probably for the first and only time before they go into a voting booth and saying, well, I'm minded to vote for X rather than Y in this situation. And let's just have a look and see whether, you know, I feel comfortable with my predisposition by the end of it. And I think that's exactly what's happened in these debates.
And Tim, let me just ask you, where will this election leave Conservatives if the Republicans lose? Because one of the factors why they will have lost is obviously that John McCain hasn't had a consistent narrative on the economy. But the other thing is that Sarah Palin has crashed and burned, hasn't she? She's been destroyed by Saturday Night Live and various comedy shows.
Well, it's very serious for the Republicans because it's not just about losing the White House. It's potentially seeing the Democrats get up to a sort of a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, making further gains in the House. The US pollster Frank Luntz is talking about this being the Republicans' equivalent of British conservatism since 1997.
Sarah Palin is a great standard bearer for conservative homespun values, and she's crashed and burned. What about that point?
Well, I think you're probably right. She gave a wonderful speech at the Republican convention, which was very choreographed. But when she's been faced with, you know, tough questions, she's struggled to answer them. She's not the only future, though, for the Republican Party. They are going into difficult wilderness years, but you've got Bobby Jindal, the new governor of Louisiana. You've got other governors around the country that actually represent, you know, possibilities for the Republicans, governors who emphasize very much on action for blue-collar Americans who aren't so strident on issues like homosexuality. And I think you will have to see a softening of the Republican brand. You'll have to see some of the lessons that actually the Conservatives in Britain have pursued, more emphasis on social justice, etc. But it's going to be tough for the Republicans, though, and it's going to take them a long time to come back.
And obviously Sarah Palin didn't spend enough on her wardrobe, Martin. Well, sorry, do come in.
Well, I think Tim's exactly right in the sense, I mean, there's potentially going to be a real bloodbath in the Republican Party after this election, because the real Conservatives are going to say that they didn't win because they chose McCain, and that if only, you know, they'd chosen somebody who had spoken the true religion, they would have been competitive and won. And there is a great sense of entitlement in the Republican Party to the White House ever since Ronald Reagan. There is a belief that there's a natural majority there, and that somehow or other the election of a Democrat represents something almost illegitimate. And I think that we remember that from the Clinton years. There may be a bit less of that in the Obama years, but who can say? I think that it's going to be a long road back for the Republicans, but the lesson for them has got to be, you know, they've got to be able to win states like California. They've got to be able to win states like New York and Ohio. You know, they've got to be able to win in middle America. They'll not win by a deep South or a desert strategy or winning Alaska. You know, it's going to be really tough. I, just as one tip, I would say no political party should ever draft a governor of Louisiana. Governors of Louisiana are, shall we say, more Central American than North American in their political style.
Why not draft a former governor of California? Bring back Ronald Reagan. Thank you for that. Well, that's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the editor of Conservative Home, Tim Montgomery, the Guardian columnist, Martin Kettle, and the Guardian's chief leader writer, Julian Glover. Politics Weekly was produced by Pascal Wise and Ben Green. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye.